Hey folks, we've got a new workshop coming up that I'm really excited about. This is a topic that I don't talk about a whole lot on the show. This is September 23rd at noon, and this is going to be about debt. I find a lot of the teaching on this particular topic is not so great. It's very one-sided, or it misses a lot of detail that I think really needs to be addressed. You know, how do we get into it? We talk about that a little bit, but there, you know, some people say, well, you'd get into it because of lack of discipline. Well, no, it often is more nuanced than that. We're going to be talking about how do you get out of it? How do we change our mindset regarding it in lots of different ways? Some of the best advice I was ever given was like over 30 years ago that helped me a lot. And I'm going to share some of that in the workshop. And we're going to talk about the little known facts and myths about credit scores. A lot of people don't understand how credit scores work. So I'm going to get into that. And people ask about, now, Paul, what about 30 versus 15-year mortgages? And people think you always do one or the other. And that's more nuanced as well. And I'm going to be talking about strategically when to use one versus another and some of the thinking regarding that. So it's going to be a great workshop. I'm really excited about it. September 23rd at noon. Join us, and you can click in the show notes to sign up or go to paulwinkler.com/debt. We'll see you there.
Welcome to the Investor Coaching Show, a podcast to help you get an insider's view of the financial world and escape common investment traps. We look at the financial news of the day and help you make sense of it so you can relax about money. And here's your host, Paul Winkler.
And a welcome. This is the Investor Coaching Show. I am Paul Winkler. PaulWinkler.com.
Yes, you are.
I got to turn your mic on before you can say anything. You're not allowed to say anything, John.
Now he's trying to figure out how you're going to start the
hour. I'm just like going through my motions here. All right. Okay, so guys.
Yes.
What makes a perfect portfolio?
Uh-oh.
Thoughts from Bogle, Markowitz, Siegel, and others.
Oh, that was, yeah.
Did you see that?
Yeah, that was in the Wolfpack.
Think Advisor. This is a financial planning publication, so somebody posted it in one of the groups. Taking a deep dive to examine philosophies of 10 prominent investing pioneers, Andrew Lowe, Stan Forster, and they have created a book, and it is the perfect portfolio. And they did this interview, and what they did is they said they looked at these five experts. What they say go into making the perfect portfolio. But he stresses, we want to encourage our readers to develop an investment philosophy. I like this and I want to come back to it, okay? I'm just going to say this one line from the article and I'm going to come back to it because I think it's key, but I think it was way too early in the article that they put this line in there. We encourage our readers to develop an investment philosophy and to have a conviction and a reason for a particular philosophy that should guide their actions. So we're going to come back to that because I think it's a key statement. There's a lot to that. As for what constitutes a perfect portfolio, the co-authors argue. You know, wait a minute. I mean, if it's perfect, then why would there be an argument, right?
Not much debate on when water freezes.
That's right. Our perfect portfolio today is really just a snapshot of what's best for you at the moment and in the current environment. Okay, guys, go. What's wrong with that statement?
That sniffs a lot like market timing to me.
Sorta, kinda. So this requires constant vigilance?
Absolutely.
We have to constantly be, you know, sticking our finger in our mouth and, you know, putting it in which way the wind blowing.
I read every article that comes out. There's only 2 billion articles on Google on investing.
Yeah. I mean, look at that. That, to me, is stress. That is tremendous stress.
So they've already advocated a philosophy in the next paragraph, haven't
they? Literally already advocated something that I would just go, no.
Yeah, interesting.
I would go, no. You know, you got to know what's going on in the economy, what's going on in the political realm, what's going on the world stage before, and make changes based on what's happening in the current, quote-unquote, current environment. Now, in the interview, Forrester discusses the philosophies of investing superstars. John Bogle, Charles Ellis, who pension guy, very well known in the pension world, Bogle, founder of Vanguard, Harry Markowitz won the Nobel Prize in 1990, Robert Shiller, Nobel Prize in 2013, Jeremy Siegel, well-known Wharton School educator and author, shedding light on both of their investing similarities and differences. Okay, so look at that. How many right answers are there? You got there are similarities and their differences. Why would there be all of these differences is a question that I would have. And let me ask you guys this. What is the problem with all of these different well-known people? I mean, you go, I've got this person, academic Nobel Prize, this person, Nobel Prize, this person, Nobel Prize, this person, Nobel Prize. When would I be likely to shift between one person's philosophy and another?
Go ahead, Ira. I talk a lot.
When you're not happy with the current results that you're getting.
Exactly. Exactly.
Performance chasing?
Yep.
If I'm with one academic.
When one guy has a better track record at the moment than the other.
Precisely. That is exactly right.
Gosh.
When you haven't come through one of our workshops and learned the truth about investing.
That's the problem. Because you look at that, when would you shift from one to another after you've been disappointed, quote unquote, that this Nobel Prize winner didn't live up to their reputation? And then you shift over to the other Nobel Prize winner that happened to have a different philosophy. And that's why this is so dangerous.
Right.
You're looking at this, and I'm going to come back to what's the answer, because it is, you look at that and go, well, wait a minute, they're all credible people. You know, in reality, active or passive and passive investing, you know, says so when they say, oh, wait a second, I missed one line. At least one says that stocks and bonds alone form the perfect portfolio. Others take a more broad-based approach. Active or passive. Forrester talks about how pioneers strongly disagree on this, along with varying opinions concerning portfolio rebalancing. Okay, so when you say somebody that's, do we do active or do we do passive?
Right.
It's a loaded question. Do we do active or we do passive? Is there maybe something in between that's a little bit more nuanced? Because if we think total passive, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
Index funds.
Index fund.
But you see, I teach that differently.
Because, okay, how do you teach it?
All right, I don't believe that there is such a thing as passive.
Okay.
Because even an index fund, if I send, let's say, Vanguard for the S&P 500, I send them $50,000.
Right.
The manager has to actively go out and buy the stocks in the fund.
Right.
If I say, you know what, I really need to put a down payment
on a
new
really
boat.
Good point.
I need to put a down payment on a boat. Send me $35,000.
Yeah.
They have to sell fund stocks in the fund and keep it balanced in order to send me my $35,000. Now, they have to do this with millions of investors.
Right.
So it's not passive. So I like to say there's two types of activity. There's active management, an index fund or a structured portfolio. And then there's hyperactive management.
Okay.
Where the managers
are
looking at the stocks in the portfolio and saying, you know what? We actually thought this would do better. It's not doing as good as we thought. We're going to get rid of it because we need the money to go buy something else. Plus, we have to invest the money that investors are sending us because we just got 5 stars, or we have to start liquidating stuff because we just got downgraded to 2 stars, and therefore we have to not only pick and choose what we're going to buy and sell within the portfolio, we have to invest or sell based upon cash flows from investors. Somebody letting me know that someone's at my front door. Sorry about that.
Are we, let me ask you this. Are we buying based on past performance when we own a mutual fund that is indexed because it mainly owns very big companies that happen to be the best performers of the past?
Well, we're not.
I would say no.
Okay. Depending on how long you owned it, I guess. But
if you
were
the fund manager or me as an investor,
yeah,
I might have misunderstood your
question.
You
as an investor.
Okay.
Yeah, you as an investor.
Yeah.
Because you think about it, it's based on the size of the company. You're overweighting the bigger companies in the portfolio. And, you know, you look at the S&P 500 right now, and you look at any of these target funds, like Vanguard's target funds and a lot of the Fidelity target date funds and the S&P 500 funds. What was it? What did I say a few weeks ago? 93% of the money invested at Vanguard is in large U.S. growth companies.
Well, it wasn't in value, which they thought was the best category.
Right. Exactly. It wasn't where they said it was going to be best. But if you look at the S&P 500, for example, you have 12% of the investment portfolio is in two stocks, Apple and Microsoft. 12% of the money in a 500 stock portfolio is in two stocks.
If someone walked in with that statement, we would say they were stock picking.
Sure.
I mean, if they just walked in and said, hey, here's my mix.
Yeah.
I'd say you're stock picking.
Yeah. And it'd be based on past performance, too, because they happen to be areas that happen to do well.
Now you may end up circling back to this when you get to the philosophy piece of this, but something that jumped out at me was the sentence where it talks about their opinions vary or something like that.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because I use the term evidence-based as opposed to passive when I'm talking about a lot of things.
That's a really good term.
You know, their opinions are going to vary. You know, my opinion of church can change from month to month, right? But scripture is not going to change.
Right.
You know, evidence is evidence. And so that's kind of where they're already letting some of the cat out of the bag of these opinions can differ.
That's
okay,
really
but I don't want to invest based on an opinion.
Yeah, no,
I
that's a super good
evidence.
Point. Yeah, that's a super good point because, the reality of it is, you can have an opinion what you think is going to do best in the coming future. And I have an opinion. I won't act on it.
Right.
I also think there are really two different type of people that are buying index funds.
Mm-hmm.
They're buying those that buy into the philosophy of you want to buy the lowest cost that there is, which cost is important,
cost.
But some of those areas of the market are just more expensive to manage, and they're not available in index funds. And then you have the investor who thinks he's very sophisticated and doesn't want to pay somebody to actually do the right job.
Right.
And therefore, their portfolios, like I met with an accountant who had over $3 million. And when he said, well, I don't see why I need you, I'm like, well, what do you have? He said, well, I have about 60% of my money in stock. I own the Vanguard S&P 500 fund and the Vanguard Total Return Fund. I said, you come into my office and the Total Stock Market Fund, excuse me.
Yeah.
I said, you come into my office and I'll show you why you do need me.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and when I showed him that he owned the same stock in both funds, and he really, it was just primarily large cap growth, and it opened up his eyes.
Case made. Yeah, so, you know, and what we're talking about right here is there's a difference between tactical asset allocation, which is where you have an opinion on what you think is going to do best next, versus strategic, which is, you know, there is a case to be made strategic because what you're doing is putting a portfolio together based on the multi-factor model and various factors that actually drive returns. Now, behavior Shiller argues that behaviors, meaning that what we're going to do is we're going to watch people's behavior and we're going to invest based on what's going on in people's minds or what's happening with their psyche in any given day, argues that individuals should get a good financial advisor. I heartily agree, and you've got to look at how you define what's a good financial advisor, really. One that good people recommend, that's kind of nebulous. Since a do-it-yourself investing isn't the best approach for many, others did others in the book advocate that too. It says Shiller is best known for uncovering irrational behaviors that many investors have. So they're basically saying, what is the job of the investment advisor? And I happen to agree with this right here. It's uncovering irrational behaviors. And even these academics are showing that they have irrational behaviors as well. And probably could use some advising.
Right.
When it really gets down to it. But of course, you know, never will. But irrational behaviors that they have, so many left to their own devices, we might trade excessively or end up underperforming, they said. And it's really, it's hard to be objective about your own money. It really gets down to it because this is my money. I got to preserve it. I can't make a mistake.
Right.
And a lot of times we do make mistakes, whether either by looking at things like you said, Ira, and only looking at one thing myopically, just, you know, the expense portion of it, or looking at and going, I'm hearing that this area of the market's selling for 38 times earnings.
Yeah.
You know, reality, that's really hard when you see that, not to get emotional and say, I'm getting everything out of there. Because you might be missing a piece of information. Like yeah. I added last segment where I actually talked a lot about that particular aspect, which is why is it that the PE ratio is so high? Well, there's a really rational reason that the layperson is not going to know. They're not going to see that. So John Bogle, founder of Vanguard, famously created the first stock index mutual fund and founded the Vanguard Group. The book quotes him as saying, stop trying to find the needle, invest in the haystack. Please explain. Well, he says, haystacks would be all the equities that might be available in the U.S. market, and the needle would be the ones that seem to be to consistently outperform. Now, which one's going to consistently outperform? How do you know? If right. we knew that something was going to consistently outperform, we just put all our money there and forget everything else. Doesn't even make sense. Blindly indexing is really what we're talking about here with the total market approach that they use at Vanguard. And, basically all the money goes into the stocks that have already performed really well and they're overweighted. Now, it says no other asset classes such as real estate or other alternatives, Bogle said. Yep, and I would agree with that. No other asset, I wouldn't be messing with that. Now, Bogle also said that in retirement, there isn't a real need. This is the one I want to get you guys on because this is good. This is interesting. Bogle said that in retirement, there isn't a real need to rebalance major asset classes. Regular rebalancing isn't terrible, but it's not necessary, is his way of thinking. What do you guys think of that?
I would agree with your retirement's going to be 5 years.
Okay. Now, that wasn't a direction I was thinking of going, but okay. If you're going to have a really, really short retirement, this may not matter. Now, you look at the late 90s. And, you've run up a portfolio and you own mostly tech because your portfolio is overweighted in all tech in the late 90s. And you're going to tell me that rebalancing, taking some of those gains off the table wouldn't have been a good idea?
Yeah. Well, it's overweighted in large tech and it's overweighted in U.S.
Right.
I would categorically disagree with that statement.
Yeah, I would too. And I actually ran some numbers just for the fun of it because I'm a number running kind of guy. Okay, so I took from 1970... I took a portfolio that is 75% stocks, 25% bonds.
Okay.
Divided up 5% in U.S. treasuries, 20% in five-year bonds, 6% large U.S. stocks, 13% small U.S., 13% large U.S. value, 11% small U.S. value, international large about 11%, international small about 21%.
Okay? Don't try this at home. He is a trained professional.
You know what's really interesting? I just named those 5%, 20, 6, 13. Your 1 year treasuries went from 5% of the portfolio to 0.49%.
Oh, if you just let it ride?
If you just let it ride.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Your 5 year bond started at 20%, right? Down to 1.3%. So your fixed income position went from 25% of the portfolio to less than 2% of the portfolio.
I'm going to hazard a guess that that's a very different risk tolerance than a 75-25 mix,
Paul. Do you think not?
That's because you're a trained professional.
I mean, that's case in point.
I'll take variance reporting for 500, Alex.
Yeah, at the end, instead of 75% stocks, you had 98.2% stocks. Yeah. At the end, instead of having a fairly even mix or more even mix, not totally even, but much, much closer, of value versus growth, you had 43% value stocks, which are distressed companies, and 11% of the whole was in growth companies. So you look at that difference, and there's four times as much money in distressed companies at the end of this period of time. Small versus large. Now, if you look at these target date funds, you'll typically find that maybe 5% of your portfolio is in small companies when you look at target date funds.
Right.
Maybe tops, right? 81.4% of your portfolio is small cap at the end of that period.
Are you saying small and value outperformed large and growth over
they
that time period?
They sort of did, man. And they're the one thing that,
What's interesting, thinking about that statement.
Yeah.
And Vanguard has, they all do now, have these target date funds.
Right.
That they're rebalancing and they're quote unquote a fire and forget portfolio.
Yeah.
Now they're actually market timing and reallocating. They're not just rebalancing. Yeah. But that doesn't even
and overweighting what just did.
Yeah.
I mean, look at that period of time and the point made, look that you're way, way overrepresented in value and small. Why? Because it did so much better.
Right.
than large in growth. And you didn't own any of it. And here we're talking about rebalancing not being important. That just absolutely boggles the mind. John Bogle, founder of Vanguard, actually talking about how regular rebalancing isn't terrible, but it's not necessary, is what he says. Guys, more thoughts on that comment.
Those kind of comments, I always relate those back to just even like relational things, mm-hmm. to kind of explore the ultimate conclusion of those kinds of statements. Not quite a thought experiment, but you know, he's a fan of rebalancing up to retirement and so forth. And
well, he's saying blanket, not just don't need to.
Yeah.
No, he's not even saying do it then.
And you know, I kind of equate that as, well, yeah, staying faithful to your wife, that's a good idea, but yeah, you don't really have to. I mean, why would – either it's a good idea and you should do it, or nobody needs to bother with it. You know, I mean, these kind of wishy-washy kind of things just really drive me crazy in the investment world.
Well, if you look at rebalancing, you say – it's something that you probably won't do until it's too late. You know, you'll go, oh, he said it's not a good idea. Because you think about it, that's really going to play into your desire to hold off on rebalancing. He says, and if I've got an asset category that's really performing really, really well, like tech stocks in the late 90s, I'm going to go, I can see his point. Why rebalance? This is taking off. This is doing really well. And as we always say, no, it's done really, really well.
Right.
You rephrase that. But you... then all of a sudden have it crash down, crumble down. And then you go, oh, I think I need to rebalance.
Well, actually, if you think about it this way. So you have $750,000 and it was, you know, let's say 25% fixed income. Now it's worth $1 million, but there's only 2% fixed income and the rest of it now is stock. So the 75 is now 98% stock.
Right.
So we can rebalance, take that profit from stock, move it into fixed income, and preserve it potentially, or we could just allow the market to rebalance it back to
for
the
us.
Level and bring it from $1 million back to the $750,000. So if you don't rebalance, the market will rebalance for you eventually.
Well, and if you look at it, you go, okay, so if I don't rebalance, technically a lot of these guys get caught in this trap and believing that rebalancing isn't necessary, because if you look at it, the return would be higher long run if you don't rebalance, because you're never selling stocks which have a higher long-term expected return.
Right.
And one of the things I did look at, Ira, was I looked at what's the difference in return of a 75% stock, 25% fixed income portfolio versus, and I looked at it over about a 50-year period, okay? So I looked at the difference between the return between them versus the difference in risk as measured by standard deviation.
Uh-huh.
You know, the return difference was only 1%.
I was going to say about 1%.
That was it.
75 versus what?
It was a 75% stock, 25% bonds, rebalanced in the one case versus not rebalanced. Now, if you don't rebalance it, you're letting stocks just grow and you're never selling anything. And technically, stocks would have a higher long-term expected return. So you're selling something with a higher expected return. Now, we always talk about the reason you rebalance is what?
To manage the risk.
Risk control, yeah.
Risk, exactly.
So you'd have probably, what, 18?
25% difference in risk. 25% difference.
Yeah.
That's where I was going next.
Yeah.
1% difference in expected return or in return over that period of time. 25% difference in the risk between the two portfolios. That is why you rebalance a portfolio. And ignoring that is greatly to the detriment and can be something. It can be a difference between retiring and not retiring.
Or staying retired, for sure.
Or staying retired. Yeah, you know, excellent point, yeah. So Jeremy Siegel, Wharton finance professor who wrote Stocks for the Long Run, recommends that at least one-third of the equity portfolio be invested in international stocks. What's his rationale? Now, typically you're going to find that is not the case, that you have a really good diversification between U.S. and international portfolio.
Right.
Typically you guys find that that's the case, that investors are mainly U.S.-centric in their portfolios?
If someone says they're diversified, I usually see that they've got about 15% maybe in international, because they think they need some.
And if they do have any international, is it large or small?
Large.
Large, yeah, exactly. Which is the worst diversifier.
But, you know, that makes sense. I mean, when you think about it, it's like we're going to invest in what we're familiar with.
Sure.
You know, I use the example that, like, when my wife and I are
makes sense. It doesn't mean it's necessarily good. Don't read into what he's saying.
Right.
It makes sense from a psychological standpoint.
No, if you follow my analogy on this.
Yeah.
When my wife and I are on road trips, like when we're driving from here to Florida, mm-hmm. okay, to our place in Florida. So if we're on the road and we're hungry, mm-hmm. we typically will tend to stop in like an Outback or a Longhorn, a name of a restaurant, a friend, you know, a big restaurant that we tend to be very familiar with because
no
we know that the food is going to be consistent,
right.
whether we're stopping at a Bonefish or an Outback or a Longhorn. So mm-hmm. people tend to invest in companies that they're familiar with.
Yeah, but it's not going to necessarily be the same type of a thing where you get a predictable outcome
like
you do at the restaurant, right?
But most investors don't realize that.
Right. No, that's true. That's a really good point.
Okay, we realize that because this is what we do every day.
We're hardwired to go to a restaurant because we know what to expect, and we're hardwired to do the same thing even though the outcomes are different.
Yes.
You get the predictable outcome with a restaurant, but you could go 20 years with no return.
Okay, so
companies that you're familiar with.
Yeah. All right. Like, so I was on the internet back in October.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Because I had gotten this diagnosis that I had cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And I was looking at all these different websites for the type of cancer that I had
mm-hmm.
and the results.
Yeah.
And they gave me basically a 5-year life expectancy. So I had asked my doctor, you know, two different doctors, should I focus on, and not that I look at investment advice from doctors, but I'm looking at my mortality here and I'm thinking about my wife.
Mm-hmm.
You know, should I be focusing on taking money and, you know, instead of building it into my retirement plan, should I be focusing more on getting my house paid off so my wife doesn't need to worry? And the doctors, both of them said, no, focus on your retirement plan because Dr. Paul wouldn't be doing this surgery if he didn't expect you to have a long life.
Mm.
So here I am reading these reports that I really don't understand. Like most people investing are reading about investments and they don't really understand how all these things work together.
Mm, right.
And they're picking and choosing what to invest in. And I'm saying, well, should I be focusing on my retirement plan or should I be focusing on my paying off my mortgage?
Yeah.
Because I'm reading stuff I don't really understand.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you were saying that because we often get into this conversation with people regarding Social Security, and I could tell you exactly the right strategy if I knew exactly how long you're going to
live. Right.
Right. And I used to use that line when people would say, well, what life insurance should I buy? I'm like, well, when do you plan to die?
Yeah, exactly. Well, so back to wrap a bow on this, the very line in the beginning of the article, but he stresses, we want to encourage our readers to develop an investment philosophy and have conviction and a reason for that particular philosophy that should guide their actions. Most people don't know why they're investing the way they're investing. They don't really understand philosophy. They don't understand the academics behind it. And when you don't understand those things, it is very easy for any of these five academics in this article to pull you in a direction based on short-term past performance. Develop the flow. That's why education is so important. That's why we spend so much time on education. Because if you don't know what you're doing, why you're doing, and what to expect, you will get pulled and swayed by every little blow of the wind imaginable. Hey, this is Paul Winkler. Hope you enjoyed today's edition of the Investor Coaching Show. If you want to learn more about what we do, go to our website, paulwinkler.com. You can watch some of the videos there, and if you're not already a client, you can set up a free initial consultation. Until next time, I'm Paul Winkler, reminding you that I believe that more educated investors are more confident investors, and confident investors are more successful investors. Have a great one.